The streetlights come on, it's getting dark. She's supposed to be home before the streetlights come on. She wasn't home yet, so I'm thinking she's just out there playing with a friend. She never came home.
She should be playing with a friend. She should be going to school and enjoying herself. Not strangled, murdered, and treated like a piece of garbage.
Seeing her laying there smoldering has tore you up. It's one of those cases that never leave you. And Stanley's making sure of that.
There's no doubt whatsoever in my mind or heart that they have the right man.
He looked at and or processed 10,000 items of evidence and never found anything that connected Jennifer and Stanley.
I mean, I like cheese, but I'm not a rat. I like kids, but not like that.
In September 1990, 9-year-old Jennifer Lewis's body was found burning on the edge of a school playground in Davenport, Iowa. This September, a jury is expected to rule whether Stanley Liggins, the man police say is responsible for this murder, is innocent or guilty. He has been convicted twice before in Iowa courts, and both convictions have been overturned on appeal. This is expected to be his final trial. Last year, Scott Reeder and WVIK, the national public radio affiliate serving eastern Iowa and western Illinois, launched the podcast Suspect Convictions. Shortly after its launch, the podcast soared to number 2 in the world on iTunes' overall chart. More importantly, it unearthed previously unreported information. The Associated Press was so impressed, it awarded the podcast its top investigative reporting honor. In the year since the investigation was completed, Lacey has been hired by CBS News and moved to New York. And Scott has continued the podcast and investigated other cases across the United States. Next week, Suspect Convictions returns to the Jennifer Lewis murder. Stanley Liggins goes on trial. Jury selection begins August 28, and after each day in court, Suspect Convictions will produce a full episode. But first, Scott and Lacey discuss their thoughts on the case so far.
So this is Scott Reeder. I'm joined today by Lacey Scarmana, who together we produced the first episodes of Suspect Convictions. Welcome, Lacey.
Hey, thank you.
Well, tell me, Lacey, what you're doing with yourself right now. A lot of people have written me and said, where's Lacey these days?
I moved to New York, and I now work as a production assistant at CBS This Morning. So I work on the TV show, but haven't been able to completely let go of podcasting. So I work on the CBS This Morning podcast as well.
Well, that's cool. That's cool. This was a really pivotal thing for your career, wasn't it? Doing this podcast?
Yeah, it was huge. It was the first project of this size that I tackled. We had a pretty good team with you and I and our other producer, Alfredo. Good. It got a lot of traction there. A lot of people listened and are curious to hear what's going to happen in this trial now.
So I was going to talk to you a little bit about that. One of the things that ran through my mind was we learned so much when we were investigating this case. I mean, there was a lot of things we didn't expect that came up. What were the biggest surprises to you when we were working on that project?
So there were a lot of surprises, just things that I think we kind of take for granted now as we watch either crime TV shows or read about actual real life crime in the newspaper and just the technology and stuff they're able to gather now. So it was crazy and surprising that back then they didn't have any actual physical evidence in this crime, and they still managed to get a couple of convictions now. So that was something surprising to me.
In fact, a past Stanley Liggins lawyer, Mike Toby, said the absence of physical evidence may be a pivotal factor in the upcoming trial.
The Des Moines criminal lab guy admitted on the witness stand that he estimated that he looked at and or processed 10,000 items of forensic-type evidence and never found anything that connected Jennifer and Stanley.
What was the toughest thing that happened during the podcast when you were, you kind of had to stretch yourself in some new ways when you were, when we were reporting on this. Why don't you tell us about the toughest things that you had to encounter?
I mean, I think obviously just the subject matter. It's about a very brutal murder of a little girl. So just dealing with that every day and reading graphic details of the case and about what happened to her was hard to deal with every day. And I don't want to say you become desensitized to it, because I think I was always affected by it, but trying to distance yourself a little bit while you're working on it. Into her mom, and then especially Jennifer's godmother, Mary, and just seeing the impact that Jennifer's death has on them to this day.
Lacey and Scott spoke often to the family members of Stanley Liggins and Jennifer Lewis. For example, Lacey visited Jennifer's mother, Sherry Glenn McCormack, in her home.
I'm going to get this open. But these are all her little things that she collected. The her classmates at school made her cards. And then she got the Bart Simpson family, still with the tags on them. She's got them all here. Here's her tennis shoes. This is probably where that thing is. This is her little thing she collected stuff in. I don't know what that is. But she had a little pet rock in here and her little knick-knack stuff. Of course, I got her Barbies.
Was it difficult for you when we interviewed Mary and Sherry, I mean, to ask questions and have that relationship?
No, I think that part came pretty naturally. I mean, as a journalist, that's just what you do. You ask questions, and it kind of gives you a free pass to ask people personal questions about their lives. So I think that part was okay. And answers when they're so obviously still upset about it. But I think having the conversations in a way is good for them as well, that people still care about Jennifer and are actively trying to figure out what happened.
What do you think happened?
I don't know. People listen and they ask me what I think, and I honestly have no idea. I don't know. It's so hard without physical links to the actual crime scene and everything. They were never able to place anybody actually there. I think there was a lot of shady things going on, sadly, around Jennifer. And I don't think the men in her life were the greatest. So whether Stanley did it or had something to do with it or knew who did it or if it was the stepdad or what, I'm not sure. But it definitely is upsetting to hear and just remember what she was living through.
During the last 20 years, innocence projects across the United States have identified jailhouse informants as a top reason for wrongful convictions. In the case of Stanley Liggins, much hinged on the testimony of his cellmate, Frank Rising. Scott Reeder interviewed Rising in Sioux City, Iowa, in late 2016.
I didn't know what he did until I got my TV in that night. And I told him, I said, "That's you, you motherfucker." And he says, "Yeah, it's me, but they'll never get me for it." And, well, they were listening on the speakers. And I was brought out of my cell and told I needed to testify or else I'd be charged with accessory after the fact.
When I interviewed Frank Rising, the cellmate of Stanley Liggins, and he said those things about why he testified, what ran through your mind at the time?
I think that he was definitely persuaded to give a specific type of testimony to them. And I think it definitely brought up questions of what kind of police or prosecution work was going on behind the scenes and just the kind of tactics they were willing to go to be able to close this case.
Prosecutors planned to call Frank Rising to testify in the upcoming trial as well. He was released from a Nebraska prison. Another key witness for the prosecution is a woman who saw taillights near the fire scene while looking out the window of a house two blocks away. Decades since Stanley Liggins' conviction, it was learned that the witness, who we are not identifying at this time, had been a paid police informant in 87 other cases, a fact that was never shared with the defense. Former Liggins defense attorney Mike Toby said he is skeptical of her testimony.
My gut just tells me that she got juiced up. I think she had some speck of some kind of knowledge. And I have never been able to find out what or how. And she was juiced up.
By who?
And, well, I would assume it had to be by investigators. I don't think there were people, you know, working the streets trying to find informants, you know, civilians. So, you know, the only other place you could look would be those who were in control of the investigation.
During a 2016 interview with Scott Reeder, she indicated that she had not had a relationship with the police.
She will deny that until she feels like she is surrounded by her protectors, the police. So if in this upcoming trial, when that is made part of a cross-examination, she will admit to being an informant.
But former Scott County attorney Bill Davis said there may have been other reasons for her denial to Scott Reeder.
He's a large man, he's a white man, and he's got a middle class bearing and accent, and no, he is not the kind of guy that she's going to react to. She wanted to keep that a secret, if even the accusation of being an informant, because in the neighborhood she lives in, and with the community that she lives in, that is truly an outcast, and she would be treated as such, and she would have to be frightened, not just treated discourteously, but maybe with some violence.
One of the challenges of the upcoming trial is that jurors will not be informed that Liggins has been tried twice before. So the reason he is being tried 28 years after Jennifer's death will not be shared. Many of the witnesses in the first two trials have died. Their past testimony will be read into the record. This may make it more challenging for the prosecution to present a compelling narrative.
So beyond, you know, this paid police informant and the cellmate, what evidence do you think the jurors will hear that will be compelling?
I think part of it will kind of be the prosecution will be able to build a story and people respond to stories. And whether it's true or not, I don't know, or if parts of it are true, I don't know. But I think that they can kind of frame this up, that this is what her life was like, and this is what the whole timeline they had built about how Jennifer was brought to the hotel and brought across the river. I think if they can hammer out those details, then it could be something that people respond to still.
Do you think this is going to be a difficult trial for the prosecution?
Yeah, it's so much later, so far removed from the actual murder. I think that's going to be really hard. I can't imagine trying to build a case that's that old when you can't go back and go to the crime scene anymore and find new evidence. People's memories have faded was something that we talked about quite a bit on the podcast. So they're relying a lot on the testimony that's given at previous trials. And clearly there were issues with both of the previous trials, and that's why they're going to a third one. Something else we touched on is I don't know how they're going to address the fact that this is his third trial or why it's taking place so much after the crime. So I think there's going to be a lot of questions they're going to have to answer for the jury to be able to understand what's going on and why their case is still compelling.
One compelling story that Judge Leslie Graves has ruled jurors likely will not hear is that of the child Stanley Liggins sexually assaulted 1 month before Jennifer Lewis's death. He was out on bond in that case at the time of the homicide.
Do you remember when we interviewed the woman who was sexually assaulted by Stanley Liggins a month before Jennifer died?
Yes.
Tell me what your impressions were of that interview.
It seemed like something that still affected her to this day and has shaped her life in some way. The way she parents now and the things she looks out for her in her own life seems like something that makes sense that it would stick with her this long. And she seemed that she felt that there was never any justice necessarily served for that, I don't think.
The victim in this case is now in her 30s and still lived in the Quad Cities area. In 1998, was living at Mylon Manor Apartments with her mom and sister. Their neighbor was Stanley Liggins' girlfriend. Brenda Adams still vividly remembers what happened on August 3rd, 1990. It was a hot day. At the end of the summer, she and Brenda's daughter were outside playing in the water. She was wearing a large shirt over a bathing suit. She and Brenda's daughter took a break from running around and sat on some steps to drink Kool-Aid. That's when she spilled some on her leg.
She goes, go in and ask my dad for a wash rag. And I said, okay, you know, so I went in and went down the stairs, and their apartment was in the basement. And in the basement, it's the only apartment that's down there. And then there's one above it on the level that you have to come down. And so I went in there and asked him if I could get a wash rag. He said, yeah, have a seat. I sat at the kitchen table, and he went into the bathroom. He locked the door, went into the bathroom, grabbed the wash rag. And in between this, I think he unlocked the door because they had came in and then left. And then he locked the door. And came back out with the wash rag and started washing my legs or my leg. And then he pulled my swimsuit over and tried to do it. Well, when he started to, I had stood up, and I don't know if there was a fear in me. So I was trying to think, oh my gosh, how do I get out of this situation? And I want to say I punched him. And when I punched him, he's a big guy. I ended up, I don't know if the Lord was watching over me or what was going on, but I ended up knocking him off his balance enough for me to get out of the kitchen to the door. I got the door unlocked, and as I was opening it, he was trying to close it. So I squeezed out the door, and then he ran after me. As I'm running up the stairs, I get to about the third, fourth stair up, and he started pulling my leg, telling me, don't tell your mom, don't tell your mom. And I'm trying to get my leg loose. So I finally broke free. And this whole time I'm screaming, and it's echoing through this hallway, and nobody comes out. And the first thing I could think of was Charlotte, one of my mom's friends, lived there's an apartment in between her and his apartment. And I thought, I didn't know anybody that lived in that one apartment. And I thought, it's going through my mind, this is so close, I got to get away from him, you know. And I didn't want to look back and see if he was following me. So I just kept running, and I ended up running to Charlotte's house. And my mom was home at the time, but I just figured if I ran all the way down to my apartment, that he would get me before I got there. So, I ran into Charlotte's, and that's when I started telling her what had happened. And then she called my mom, and my mom came over, and we talked about it. I told her what had happened. And then the police were called, and they came and took a statement, and that's when it all went down.
Yeah, you know, I don't know if I ever shared this with you, Lacey. I mean, I wrote a newspaper column about it after you'd left for New York, but when I was 12, I was sexually assaulted. And that's just something that sticks with you for the rest of your life. I mean, it's just a really horrific thing that happens in your life.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just a one-time physical thing. It's something that affects you deeply mentally as well, and can kind of seep into how you perceive things and how you approach life.
An interesting aspect of this trial is that the prosecutors in this case, Mike and Julie Walton, are brother and sister.
One of the things that I think is really curious about this case, I've never seen it before, but you have a brother and a sister working together to prosecute it. When you were sitting in the courtroom during those pretrial hearings, what did you think the dynamics were between Mike and Julie Walton?
I knew that they were related, but I don't think that necessarily came across in any way in the courtroom. It seemed like they had separate roles. They would kind of take turns who was presenting their arguments or asking questions, and I didn't see much interaction really between them.
How would you describe the courtroom demeanor of each one of them?
I'm trying to think back. I don't remember either of them like grandstanding too much or anything or being super charismatic. I remember Mike kind of being pretty matter of fact.
Very methodical is what I remember.
Yeah.
And Julie struck me as the more charismatic of the two. She had a little bit more of an edge when she was in the courtroom and she was interacting with the defense. You could tell they just had different courtroom styles. I mean,
she had, I guess, a little more personality shown through.
A good example of Julie Walton's temperament coming through can be heard when she cross-examined the mother of the child Stanley Liggins sexually assaulted the month prior to Jennifer's death. This was during a pretrial hearing when prosecutors unsuccessfully sought to have his prior conviction admitted into evidence.
At some point, did you guide A.S. out of the courtroom during that trial in the spring of 1991?
Yes.
And did something remarkable occur as you were guiding A.S. out of the courtroom?
Yes.
Can you describe for the court what occurred as you were guiding A.S. out of the courtroom?
Stanley Liggins threatened to kill my daughter.
Prosecutors Mike and Julie Walton argue that Stanley Liggins learned his lesson after he got arrested for sexually abusing A.S.
We also intend with regard to motive and intent. The fact that less than a month, a little over a month after the A.S. allegations in which the defendant was arrested and he was out on bond for, a little over a month after those allegations, Mr. Liggins lured Jennifer away and murdered her. And it was clear that that was done based on what he had learned August 3rd of 1990, because A.S., you'll see from the transcript, screamed, ran for help, and was able to talk to the police and identify Mr. Liggins and what he had done to her, and the police arrested him. So on September 17th of 1990, Mr. Liggins wasn't going to let that happen again. So rather than choose to attack a little girl near her own home and around her friends, he lured her away in his vehicle and he murdered her so that this little girl couldn't talk.
During an earlier pretrial hearing, Julie's brother, Mike, cross-examined Stanley Liggins' appellate lawyer, Kent Simmons, about police reports that were not turned over to the defense. The withheld police reports were the basis for Liggins being granted a new trial. The cross-examination illustrates Mike Walton's methodical courtroom style.
And that's the sum and substance of those reports that were not provided, those three reports out of the four that were not provided to the defense for those two trials.
Well, I don't think you stated everything that's in the reports, but those reports are the complete reports, yes.
Well, should I read the reports in their entirety?
Objection, argumentative.
It's overruled.
Is that the gist of what is in those reports?
Yes, you have to put the three reports together, though, to see how it makes sense.
Is there anything that's contained within the three reports that you think I left out or that you should put in the record to make it more accurate?
Only if I were to make an argument as to what the evidence shows.
I'm just talking not what you think it shows. What is there anything that you think I left out that you think should be made part of this record, because we can put it in right now?
Do you want me to explain what the evidence shows?
No. Okay. That's not my question.
And the answer is no, you left nothing out.
All right. So what we just went through covers what is in these reports.
Correct.
You know, and you and I had this discussion, I remember. I said, you know, I could never prosecute a case with my sister without the two of us being at each other's throats. And don't get me wrong, I love my sister to pieces, but our personalities are such that we would drive each other nuts trying to get something like this done. But you told me you didn't think you'd have any trouble doing something like this with one of your siblings.
Yeah, I don't think so. I have three brothers. It's hard to picture us working together just because we all work in very different fields right now. But personality-wise, I don't think we would clash. I think we'd be able to come together as a team pretty well, honestly.
The issue of race looms heavily over this case. Jennifer Lewis was white. Stanley Liggins is black. Because of extensive media coverage of the case, the trial has been moved to Black Hawk County, the most racially diverse county in Iowa. It is 12% African American.
You know, one of the things that really struck me as odd that Jennifer's mother, Sherry, said is that she really wanted it to be known that this was some sort of business transaction is the reason why Stanley was in her home. He was there to sell her drugs for her to sell. Because she said, the jurors are just sitting there and they're thinking, why is this black man coming to this white woman's home while her husband's in jail? And I'm thinking, that seems to me a really strange thing to be worried about. I mean, I would think people would be much more worried about the stigma of being associated with illegal drugs than that. But does that strike you as strange?
Oh, yeah. I mean, racism seeped into this case quite a bit, and ideas of race, that being one of them. Obviously, the juror being another. There's a lot of weird, offensive perceptions being thrown around, I think.
Here is what the juror, Kevin Forder, told Suspect Convictions.
I've grown up with black people all my life, you know, in Africa, and most of them, you know, they can be, I won't say threatening, but they do appear sometimes to be aggressive looking or, you know, I don't want to sound like a racist or anything like that. You know, the black people, I think, have had a really bad deal in this, as a global population. I think, you know, they've been discriminated against greatly. And, you know, I have the philosophy that we were also in the same predicament as them thousands of years ago. You know, it's just civilization comes about by time and evolution and, you know, character building and stuff like that. We didn't jump out of the trees overnight and become civil like we are today, you know. So they're on that process of, I think, becoming like we are. I mean, I'm sure if you look back in time, I think we were all black originally. We all came from Africa by all appearances, you know, from anthropology. And I think the reason our skins changed color was because the white people moved north and they lived in a colder climate. And you never ever saw a black polar bear, did you? So I'm assuming that's why our skins ended up white. We had to figure out a way to cook. We had to figure out a way to stay warm and our brains grew larger and we ended up with white skin. So having lots of sunlight and lots of food and, you know, in a situation where they really didn't have to think much about food gathering and survival, they stayed pretty primitive. Not that that's a bad thing.
Yeah, that's one of the things I've forgotten to ask you about. The South African juror.
Yeah.
What was your reaction when you heard, when I brought that tape in for you to listen to?
Yeah, that was one. That was an interview you had done before we actually started working on the podcast.
Yes.
So I listened to it afterwards, and it was insane. clearly, this guy is racist and is trying to explain it away with some faulty scientific evidence that made no sense. And it's crazy that he kind of slipped through the cracks there and made it onto this jury.
And his wife. And his wife made it onto the jury. I've never heard of a husband and a wife on the jury before, yet alone one that with that kind of background.
Yeah, and if he was that vocal in a taped interview about race, then I imagine he's discussed that with his wife. And so I don't know if they think the same or what, but that, those are two pretty questionable jurors to have.
Well, you know, and the other thing that ran through my mind is, you know, the jurors are all instructed not to discuss the case amongst themselves until they go into deliberations. What do you think the odds are this husband and wife sit through 8 hours of testimony in a day, go home and sit down to have supper and, so, well, how was your day? I can't talk about it, dear. Well, how was yours? I can't talk about it. I mean, it just seems pretty far-fetched to me that there's not discussions going on there.
Yeah, I'm not married, but when big things happen, I like to, you know, debrief them with my mom or a friend or something. So I get that that would be hard to talk about. And maybe if I were a juror on a trial, that'd be easier to kind of distance. But if they are sitting on that same jury and you're hearing the same things, I feel like you'd be more inclined to talk about them.
Yeah, I would think so. I mean, I can't I'm married and I've been married for 15 years, and I can't imagine not going home and discussing what happened that day with my wife, you know, the person that's most important to me in my life.
Yeah.
But yet alone for the two of you to share the same experience that day,
right,
to hear this dramatic testimony, and then not talk about it when you got home.
Another issue certain to be raised by the defense is the integrity of the police investigation, and the focus of their questions will likely be the man who led the investigation, Donald Schaefer. He was a lieutenant at the time of Jennifer's death and eventually rose to being Davenport's police chief. Ken Simmons, a lawyer who has represented Stanley Liggins, accused Schaefer of using a police slush fund money to pay a witness in the Stanley Liggins case. Scott Reeder and Lacey Scarmana interviewed Kevin Murphy, who was a detective in the department at the time of that investigation. We asked him if that sounds like something Don Schaefer would have done at the time.
Could you see him doing something like that? I mean, we're giving money to somebody that's going to testify against in a trial and just, you know.
That's a tough question to answer.
Murphy's wife walked in the room, but Scott came back to question.
Anyway,
we were talking about Schaefer.
Do I see him doing that?
Could you see him doing something like that? Would it be out of character? That's an awful long pause, Murph.
You know, that's a tough question, Scott. You know, it's just... I think I'd like to hold off on that question until after the trial.
That's fine.
Kevin Murphy died of cancer January 25th, 2018. We will never know what he planned to say after the trial. Another mystery is the whereabouts of Jennifer's stepfather, Joe Glenn, who the defense has portrayed as the alternate suspect. Scott Reeder traveled to New Orleans, the last known location for Joe, and showed his photograph to homeless people.
I seen him yesterday.
Yesterday? Where?
Yeah, yesterday. I seen him down there on Decatur. He got the same hair and the mustache.
That's a 10-year-old photo now.
Yeah, I know. But he got a beard now.
Okay.
Yeah, he got a beard. I seen that face, though.
You ever seen him?
if I'm not mistaken, because damn near after a period of time, they all go to looking at the beard thing. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, this is a 10-year-old photo.
Yeah, but I'm saying, because see, sometimes they let the beard grow, but, I don't want to lead you the wrong way, okay? Uh-huh. But there is a guy, a similarity to this one. He bees this way.
Okay.
Back over here.
What kind of places do you see this guy at, just out of curiosity?
I don't know him all that well. I see him walking around here and there.
Does he panhandle, or does he...
I'm really not for sure, dude. I try to keep myself isolated from people.
Now, he may... Now, it's the same person I know, which has lost a lot of weight. He's got a ponytail now.
Okay.
He hangs out at Jackson Square.
At Jackson Square?
Jackson Square, down with the gypsies. Down there.
I haven't seen him lately now. I haven't seen him in a month. I know you're talking about. I just seen him walking around eating with us. I haven't seen him lately.
Where's he hang out?
Like everybody else around the park and whatnot.
About around where?
Around here. Where else they going to hang? Around here.
I don't know. Maybe the library.
The library?
Yeah.
The public library.
You go in there and get on the internet. Get on the internet.
Do you think that Jennifer's stepfather is still alive?
Oh, I don't know. I hope so. I think it'd be really interesting to hear from him.
Well,
I don't know how you go off the grid in 2018.
Well, you know, I'll be honest with you. I had an interesting conversation with Mike Walton, the prosecutor, about a month ago. He called me up and he wanted to know if I had any contact with him and with the stepfather. And I said, no, you know, I drove down to New Orleans with my nephew and the two of us spent 3 days down there hunting for him. And we encountered a lot of people who knew who he was. They caught a lot of people. We found computer records that he'd stayed in a particular homeless shelter down there. We found evidence of his being there, but we never did find him. And he said to me, he thought that his nickname was Ace, that Ace was either dead or incarcerated under a different name somewhere in the United States, because he said he thinks that he would have turned up by now.
I mean, that makes sense.
Yeah, you know, I thought about it, though, and I got thinking, well, Ace was somebody who had a criminal past, so his fingerprints would be in the systems, and wouldn't they, if they lock somebody up, wouldn't they have run his fingerprints first to make sure he's who he says he is?
Yeah, I think he was homeless at the time. You were down there trying to find him, so I guess that's... You're kind of untraceable if you're not linked to an address and a job and things like that. It'd be hard to keep track of him.
Next week, lawyers begin selecting jurors for the Stanley Liggins trial, which may last as long as 3 weeks. Scott Reeder will be there for each day of testimony, providing daily episodes as jurors ponder, is Stanley Liggins innocent or guilty?
In court cases that end in a conviction, victims and their families are often allowed to make an impact statement, a statement of record of what they had before the crime and what they were left with after. But for unsolved crimes, crimes that don't end in a conviction, or serious life-altering events that aren't crimes at all, there is nowhere for the victims or their families to speak. Impact Statement is a new podcast that talks to victims and their families about life before, during, and after a life-changing event. Impact Statement combines compelling narration with interview clips to give a clear retelling while allowing those who have been affected the most to speak. Impact Statement can be found in Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app.